Gutman. It is the Big Three here on VSiN, the Sports Betting Network. Usually it is the young and great looking face of Danny who is bringing us in here. But today it is me, slovenly and somewhat older. But we also have a youngster here at the desk. Nick Henyon is alongside. Our Big Three today has a theme. It is English Premier League Soccer. I do think it's rather insulting, by the way. We're in America. Technically, it's just Premier League Soccer. Regardless, the three biggest games of the weekend, Nick. So I give the floor to you. Game number one. What do you got on deck?
Wolverhampton versus Arsenal. Okay. Undoubtedly the biggest game of the week. I don't think this is as easy as a side call as people are making it out to be. Wolves tied first most points since match day 25. Arsenal tied third most points since that same match day. It was 1-1 at the Emirates in the reverse leg back in November. I think what you're looking for here is a lot of goals. I think that Arsenal was fighting for a Europa League spot. Wolves are still fighting for a Champions League spot in theory. So I think these are two teams that are desperate and honestly have had their offensive firepower since the restart has happened. You know, Arsenal only have three clean sheets on the road this season. Wolves have kind of struggled against the top tier teams at home. I'm looking at over 2.5 goals here. I got a plus 110 here at the South Point.
We should also note, of course, the three-way line. Arsenal plus 235, Wolves plus 125, a draw at plus 225. A goal line, lay and a half goal with the Wolves. Minus the half, plus 125. So you said over 2.5 with that?
Over 2.5 my play. Slight lean to the Wolves on the side, but not a confident.
Really quickly, note, because we didn't get to this earlier in the week, the Wolves, as you said, theoretically fighting for a Champions League spot. That also has to do with Man City, right, and everything going on there, because a fifth-place spot could theoretically get them into the Champions League.
Correct, JVT. It is entirely dependent on City's ban being upheld. If that ban is upheld as people expect it to be, Wolves in that fifth spot would be a Champions League side.
All right, next up, what is the second game?
Next up, Chelsea against Watford tomorrow. Chelsea coming off a loss against West Ham on the road in the midweek. Really simple handicap here. Chelsea against bottom four teams at home in the last three seasons. 9-0-1 straight up. Of those nine wins, six have come by two or more goals. Watford, 0-2-6 against top half teams this year. I like Chelsea. I laid a goal at the South Point against Watford. Minus 140 was the price for me.
I like it. All right, three-way line two, 245 Chelsea, plus 745 for Watford, draw plus 350. They gave up three goals in that game to West Ham. What was that? Just a hangover type of deal or what?
Some type of hangover. They're really bad at defending set pieces, and West Ham, as bad as they've been this year, is really good at set pieces. A couple of bad breaks Chelsea's way, but yeah, I think it's just a blip on the radar. They absolutely need to win this game, too. They're in a very precarious position. 1 point behind Leicester for third, but 2 points away from being out of a Champions League spot. A much-needed win here needed for Chelsea.
All right, Nick Henyon again with us as we're talking about the three biggest games in the Premier League coming up this weekend. Third game on deck. What do you got?
Burnley and Sheffield United on Sunday. Sheffield's coming off an impressive win against Tottenham in the midweek. Not a lot of people expected them to win that game. I'm looking at the total here. I think this is a tough side match to call, but because, you know, Burnley and Sheffield do a lot of similar things, and neither team really likes to play with the ball. I think under two, is the play here, but some trends bettors should know. Sheffield under 2.5 in 75% of their away games. Burnley under 2.5, 50% of their home games. And then the system I have built for this one, in the 91 completed home and home legs so far this season, where at least one leg has gone over 2.5 goals, only 39 have had both legs go over 2.5 goals. This was a 3-0 victory for Sheffield in the reverse leg at home in the earlier this season. I think you're looking at, honestly, a 0-0 candidate here. Two goals pushes the total for me. I grabbed it at minus 115 over at the Westgate.
You're doing a great job. I will say at this desk, it's 0-0. It's not 0-0. Really quickly, in the last 30 seconds here, I'm going to put you on the spot. Give me a yes or a no in 10 seconds of analysis. Sheffield, 5 points behind for a potential Champions League spot. Yes or no?
No.
No?
I think Europa League is realistic, right, but I don't think they have the offensive firepower to make their way into Champions League.
All right, I like it. Where can people find you on social media?
You can find me at Nick Henyon.
There it is. Nick Henyon with the three biggest games in the English Premier League this weekend. Rule is he has to go 3-0 or else he's not allowed back up here. So, of course, if you want to root for Nick, if you liked it, wait until he got your money. We will have that next Friday.
This is The Edge with your hosts, Jonathan Von Tobel.
By the way, we play. I don't want to crush Nick Spear. That's a very good spot. So look forward to seeing what's going to happen this weekend. I would have picked three different games, but whatever. It is The Edge here on VSiN, the Sports Betting Network. I think we got a great show on tap coming up in just a couple of minutes. Paul Gutierrez is going to join us. Covers the Raiders for ESPN, one of their NFL Nation reporters. Yes, the Raiders are up in our power ratings. We'll talk about them. I think there's a really there's a lot of fascinating things around the Raiders, and that, of course, a lot has to do with the move here to Las Vegas and in Southern Nevada. But there's also other aspects of this team, specifically a defense that over the last three seasons has really struggled to create turnovers and pressure quarterbacks. So we'll have all those analysis details with Paul Gutierrez and a little on the AFC West, too, if we have time. Later in the show, Nothing But Analytics comes back today. The Miami Heat, a fascinating team, are the subject of our analysis today. And then the NL West is going to be in our sights as we preview these divisions, AL West beginning of the week, NL West today, to send you off into the weekend. But we start with the PGA Tour as we are well underway for the second round over in Detroit. And if you think or thought that this course was going to play easy, as we all thought, round two, these guys kind of exploded. What was going on at this point? We have, not only do we have some names that I don't think some people expected at the top of this board, we just have some strong names in general, like in terms of what I would name my next child, because these are actually some really, really solid names. Your leader right now, tied, actually a four-way tie at the leader, Seamus Power at the top of the leaderboard with Matthew Wolf, two Fs, Bryson DeChambeau, Mark Hubbard, all of these guys sitting at 11 under par. It's a four-way tie. Should note that Power, Wolf, DeChambeau, Hubbard, all in the clubhouse. They are done for their day. Matthew Wolf really having his way with the course, out of the leaders, having the easiest time with the course. He had finished the day 64, 8 under at one point, had birdied six consecutive holes. So he was working his way down the course with no problem whatsoever. So those are your four leaders in the clubhouse, some guys that have made some pushes. Kevin Kisner sits at 10 under, along with Sepp Straka and Brandon Hagee. All three of those guys, 10 under. Should note that Hagee is through 16, so he is still going at this point right now. And then we have the late guys teeing off at this point. Ricky Fowler actually just got on the course. He is on one. Looks like he's got about, I would say, a 20 to 18-foot putt for birdie on the first hole. He is at 5 under, so we'll see if he can make that push and start to make that push. Some notable performances from earlier today. I really just got to watch a couple of people, mainly because of the featured groups and what was going on. Should note that one of the guys that I have, Hideki Matsuyama, he finishes the day at 5 under. Really up and down day for Hideki on this course. The putter really let him down. If you go to the second and third hole, he bogeyed both of those consecutively, started to get things together. He had back-to-back three putts, which was absolutely awful. He couldn't figure out the greens whatsoever. There was a couple where he got a little tentative. Like, look, he had a few spots. He had about 25 putts for birdie. But he didn't want to get aggressive and try to challenge the hole, so that was clear, and that led to a couple of three putts, which really let him down. So the putter was really inconsistent with Hideki Matsuyama. Yeah, I would say as was the approach game too, by the way. He was consistently setting himself up with these 25-foot putts for par, and he wasn't really getting near the pin, so that was part of the game that was letting him down. On top of that, though, you know, a couple of these guys that have just teed off, Doc Redman through four is already down two strokes, right? So he is at 9 under, pushing for a potential lead, just two strokes out. Victor Hovland, who shot a 69 yesterday, finished his round today with a 67. So he's making his push near the top of the leaderboard. He is at 8 under for the tournament, done for the day. Webb Simpson just got started. He's part of this group with Ricky Fowler. So that is on the course right now. These guys just getting started. We'll see. I would also note, too, one of the more notable performances of the day. Bryson DeChambeau, as I mentioned, shot a 67 today after a 66 yesterday on Thursday. There was a par four, and I cannot remember which hole it was, but about a 360-yard par four. DeChambeau laced one right down the middle. He almost essentially reached the green. The guy is ridiculous with the driving, and it's really working out for him. And the pace of play, actually, it's a good point that they had brought up on the broadcast. DeChambeau had been getting destroyed in months prior because his pace of play had been awful, but he's really picking it up. The yokedness of Bryson DeChambeau really helping out with the game, but he looks absolutely phenomenal and right near the top of the leaderboard. But watch out for a couple of these guys. This is going to be a good tournament because the way this course is playing, not sure a guy like Lashley last year who pulled away from this pack because it wasn't as great in terms of the field. Maybe we won't have that. We'll have a good end to this tournament. But let's head out to the phone line. Let's welcome in Paul Gutierrez, ESPN NFL Nation reporter for the Raiders, now the Las Vegas Raiders. Paul, we appreciate some time today. I appreciate it. So I wanted to start with this because So here on the show, we do these market power ratings, right? And what we do is we gauge how the market views these teams in the National Football League, and we set up ratings as it. So it's not subjective. It's literally just how the market views these. All numerical. Raiders right now are on the 78 line that would put them on par with the Jets and Bears, favored on a neutral over a few other teams as well. But if you just hear that, like Jets, Bears, Raiders are equivalent to that in that in this market. What do you think of that? Do you think that's fair?
I think that's fair, and I think Raider fans would actually take that, especially if they're linked to the Bears, because there's still a lot of feelings, bad, good, otherwise, regarding the Khalil Mack trade. And, you know, that thing is finally done. You can close the books on it. The Raiders come out of that with Damon Arnette, the cornerback who has yet to play, and Josh Jacobs, who would have been the NFL Offensive Rookie of the Year had he not missed three of the last four games last year. So I think that's fair for the team. They're a team that's on the upswing. They're a team that was three plays away, literally, from being 10 and 6 last year. But then they were also three plays away from being 4 and 12. So they're a team that's right there in the middle. They've got a lot of continuity. And the only time continuity is a good thing is when you're on the upswing. And you know, with this crazy offseason and no interaction, they're one of these rare teams that I believe is on that upswing because of the continuity and because of where they're going and where they've been. And oh yeah, the Bears, they beat them last year. So I think the Raider fans would take that in a heartbeat.
So before we get to the specifics of the team, let's talk about the elephant of the room, because we have seen in years past, the Rams are a good example when they made the transition to LA, kind of a distraction, didn't exactly go particularly well the first year. What do you make of the transition on top of the pandemic that we're dealing with right now? It's an awkward transition already. Now you have to deal with everything on the outside. What do you think in terms of being a distraction, moving to Las Vegas, everything they have to deal with before we actually get to the first snap of the season?
Yeah, it's a unique situation, definitely, because like I mentioned with the continuity, you got a lot of guys that have been around at least for the past 2 years and under John Gruden's system. By the same time, you've got a lot of young guys on there that don't know any better. So going from Oakland and the ramshackle facilities, if you will, that they had to deal with in Alameda, and now you're going to a state-of-the-art type situation in Henderson, state-of-the-art stadium, in Allegiant Stadium, it's almost like they won't know any better, so there won't be that kind of a distraction, so to speak. So it's interesting to see it go that way. And when you look at somebody like a Derek Carr, I think he actually benefits from this because this is for the first time in his career. He's going into an offense for the third straight season, the same offense. He's never had that before. He's only done it a couple times where he's gone 2 years in a row. So there really are no excuses anymore. You know, you talk about the distraction. Well, I don't know about that, but it's interesting that these guys are already kind of making themselves at home. You see the video that Derek Carr posts up, and at first you think it might be the volleyball scene from Top Gun with all the shirtless Carr brothers that are out there. But they're getting their work in. I know the NFL advised players to not do group workouts right now, and Carr put out another video yesterday, at least working out with one guy. So, you know, I don't know if it's so much a distraction as it's an exciting time for them because there's this unique blend on the roster of continuity of older veteran guys who know how to deal with this and young guys that, you know, it's just like, you know, jumping straight into the water and just getting used to it.
If you see, if you're watching the broadcast, 80-1 to win the Super Bowl for the Raiders, 30-1 to win the AFC, 12-1 to the AFC West, and 7.5 in terms of the season win, which we'll get to, and we'll get Paul's thoughts on those. So let's start with the offense, natural jumping off point since you talk about Carr. Yeah. I wanted to start, you know, I didn't, because I know you've probably gotten this question 1,000 times because quarterback is the most important position. So we'll get it out of the way. How short is the leash for Carr? How realistic is the chance that he is supplanted at one point by Marcus Mariota? I'm of the belief there's no shot in terms of week one that Marcus Mariota overtakes him. But there is thoughts and conversations that maybe if he is not performing up to snuff, that Mariota is biting at the heels and then could eventually take over, a la what happened to him in Tennessee last year.
Yeah, it's interesting because, again, with Derek, like I mentioned earlier, I mean, the pandemic and the shutdown in a weird way, and I'm not going to, you know, credit it because this is real world stuff we're talking about here, but it's almost benefited him more because he's already entrenched in the system. Marcus Mariota doesn't know the system. Nate Peterman knows it a little bit, but he was on IR all last year. And then with the draft and the way they did, and they picked up some pieces here and there, there really are no excuses for Derek going forward. And he'd probably be the first to tell you that as well. You know, last year you had plenty of excuses with the Antonio Brown meltdown and getting cut and the entire offense really being built around him. And you still felt it at the end of the year. So the leash, I believe, is going to be longer. It's going to get shorter as the season goes on. Marcus Mariota doesn't know this offense. And yet Marcus Mariota's skill set is closer to what John Gruden wants in this offense anyways. And when you look back at what John Gruden and Mike Mayock said when when Mariota was coming out in 2015 as a Heisman Trophy winner, John Gruden advised the Titans to build their offense around him. Mike Mayock said, yeah, consider this guy, his skill set, his athleticism on a par with Colin Kaepernick. So there's no, once they get him in the building and start running plays and things, that's when the leash starts to short, especially if they get off to a tough start. You look at the contract situations, and that makes it a little more tenable later on as the season gets going.
Yeah, it's funny too. Like, so when I was looking at some of their numbers, especially when it looked like Carr in this offense, right? What I always find interesting about the dynamic with Carr, Paul, is like the numbers actually aren't terrible, right? Like, I think if you were to pull some teams that don't have quarterbacks, and you were to say, "Hey, I have a quarterback here who threw for over 4,000 yards, had a career high in yards per attempt, 21 touchdowns to 8 interceptions," they would take that. And what I thought was more fascinating, like you think about the Raiders overall last year, like a team that likes to run the ball. If you looked at the DVOA metrics, they were 7th in terms of their passing game, and actually 21st in terms of their running game. So like, there's all these things that actually kind of lend themselves to think that Carr's not that bad numbers wise. But like, when you watch him in the narrative, it's that he is not performing well. Can you explain that?
Yeah, it's weird in that he's coming off a career high in passing yards, over 4,000 yards. He's coming off a career high in completion percentage, over 70%. Where fans run into it and the Carr detractors bring up their points is the strange decision-making at times. Yeah. Not all the time, and you can pull them out. It's the throwing the ball away on fourth down rather than trying to let somebody make a play. It's fumbling the ball through the end zone for a touchback to give the ball away, as he did against Dallas a couple of years ago, as he did in Green Bay this past season. So there's those things. And you know, I think a lot of fans look at him and say, okay, well, he's just simply not the same gunslinger that he was in 2016 when he was playing at a league MVP-type level. I mean, that year he finished tied for third in MVP voting before he broke his ankle in the second to last game. So there's just something that's kind of missing. You look at just the pure numbers, and if you're a stats-driven guy, you say, hey, what's the problem here? I mean, this guy's playing well with no weapons. And then you look at it and you go, okay, well, he's ready to take that next step because for the first time in his career, he's getting ready to play in the same system for the third year in a row. So a jump should be expected. Okay, now he's got the fastest guy in the draft in Henry Ruggs. He's got all his pieces back. He's got a stout offensive line. There should be no excuses going forward. So it's kind of hard to kind of compartmentalize all this and say, okay, well, he stinks. We'll be better off moving forward. But yet there's still that sense out there because there is this continuity, and continuity is king, especially in the NFL.
All right, let's look at the running game really quickly because I was actually pretty surprised by this. So they ranked 8th in the National Football League in terms of percentage of plays that were run plays. Over 44% of their plays were runs. In terms of efficiency in the run game, as I mentioned, Paul, they were 21st. But we have this dynamic where, like, PFF just came out with their offensive line ratings. They have the best offensive line according to Pro Football Focus. If you looked at the Football Outsiders metrics, it was the 6th best run-blocking offensive line in the NFL. So why was the run game inefficient last year, and can it improve this year?
Yeah, and that's strange to hear that because just looking at it, you think, okay, well, the run game was a strength, right? I mean, Josh Jacobs was a beast. So, again, you can play whatever game you want with the numbers. Why? And I think a lot of that probably was at the end of the year last year when Josh Jacobs, like I mentioned, missed 3 of the last 4 games. DeAndre Washington stood up pretty well in a win over the Chargers. But other than that, the running game was kind of non-existent. So, you know, 16 games happens pretty fast. If Jacobs is healthy, you know, he played basically half of the season with a fractured shoulder before he couldn't go on anymore down towards the end of the season when they were still in the playoff hunt. So they're still missing that big piece, I think, a big bruising type back to could be the change of pace back to Josh Jacobs. But yeah, it's interesting to play with those numbers because, again, like we were talking about Carr, you look at the stats and it looks good. It's the scoring. And it comes to the running game as well. It's scoring. They don't score enough touchdowns. And that's what it comes down to, I believe, when it comes to efficiency and this John Gruden offense.
All right, last couple minutes here with Paul Gutierrez, again, a reporter, ESPN NFL Nation reporter for the now Las Vegas Raiders. You know, I'm going to skip the win total stuff because I actually want to get in this defense before we get you out of here. Because so we have a guy like Max Crosby, 10 sacks last year, looks like a good developmental piece, but they struggled with turnovers. They've had for the last 3 seasons. They really invested free agent-wise on this defense. Can they become a better defense in terms of forcing turnovers and getting explosive plays this year?
Yeah, you talk about no excuses. I mean, Paul Gunter, the defensive coordinator, I mean, I think he's on his last life here as well. I mean, they've attacked defensive side of the ball really, really hard in free agency, the draft a little bit too. So that's definitely something they need to do. I texted with John Gruden during the draft and asked him how much how important it was to get more aggressive on defense. And so we just have to get better. And along with that comes forcing turnovers. I mean, I remember a couple of years ago when they didn't have an interception until midway through the season, yep. and that interception came from Navarro Bowman, a linebacker.
By the way, so, Paul, I remember that clearly because we were on the air. He was laying on the ground in the end zone, and it fell into his lap.
Yes, exactly. So it just kind of – that's literally what this offense needs to do. The offense has to start – I mean, I'm sorry, the defense has to start making plays for Paul Gunther. And a lot of the guys that came over, they like his system. They like what it presents. And I tell you what, their crown jewel of the free agency class should be Corey Littleton, because he's, you know, an undersized linebacker, but that's where the NFL is going. Undersized guys who can cover sideline to sideline. And that's where it all starts and begin and ends there, because once you got the coverage, then you got the guys that can rush the passer. And if you got a fearsome pass rush, then you got guys in the back that can cover for a lot longer. So it works hand in hand.
Paul Gutierrez again, ESPN Raiders reporter. Paul, thank you very much, man. We're up against it. I could talk for a while more, but we do have some things we take care of. Thank you very much, man.
My pleasure, and that's why we didn't talk about unexplained mysteries. I got you.
That's right. Yeah, Paul Gutierrez, ESPN Raiders reporter. Yeah, we have plenty to get to, too, and we're up against it. So on the other side, we'll quickly go over, not in detail, but the expected win total, which, by the way, I'm going to have to go back over the numbers for the Giants again. So I did the math again this morning on the Raiders. Their expected win total came out at 2.9, and I was like, all right, there's something going on. I redid it, and I have a better total now. So we'll talk about that. I'll rerun the Giants numbers, and we'll come back maybe on Monday and have that. But when we come back, we'll have that in our clip of the week before we get into the second half of our program here on The Edge. Minutes or last few seconds on the Raiders and what their expected win total. Again, we do all the power rating numbers and we crunch it out again. Market power rating, market expectations. The way the Raiders are currently power rated by the market, I should say. Expected win total came out to 6.8. So it's actually kind of right in line with the market, right? Some win totals, some operators have 7, some operators have 7.5. So 6.8 in terms of the expected win total deemed by the market. It seems pretty online for where the Raiders are at and everything. So just wanted to make sure to get that out there, that, again, if you're looking at these market power ratings, where they stand right there. By the way, I misspoke. They're on the 79 line, a point ahead when we were talking with Paul of the Jets and the Bears. But putting that all together, setting point spreads for their entire schedule, comes out to an expected win total of about 6.8. So right on line with what the market is. But regardless, it is Friday. It is our B block. You know what time it is. Let's do it. Clip of the week.
At with Tampa Bay, and do you agree with me that they could be this year's Cleveland, where the public will be all over them every week?
I was down on them last time we spoke. I have Tampa just less than 9 wins in my initial ratings. I'm coming around just a little bit on them. Like, it was never the point where I was running to bet any unders necessarily, but it was like a team where I was looking to stay away for sure, and then likely to oppose them quite frequently during the season and spots where I felt the number was inflated. But the addition of Gronkowski didn't do much for me. I mean, that was, to me, just a strange situation that got overblown, probably more so than this Cam Newton to the Patriots is. If they get Antonio Brown now and put that speed and that weapon within that offense, that certainly makes it look a lot different. I still have huge concerns about the defense. And like you mentioned, Bruce Arians, with quarterbacks in his system for the first year, if you look back through all the guys, Roethlisberger, Luck, Palmer, Jameis last year, it's when they get hit the most and it's when they have the most turnovers. There's a spike in those as well. So everything that he has said is implying that Tom Brady is going to be put into this system and forced to throw the ball downfield. It doesn't seem like Arians is budging a lot. And when you look at Brady over the last 3 years, when it comes to deep passing accuracy, and that's including a very good 2017 campaign, as we know, like those numbers were on the decline from what we know of Brady, especially pushing the ball downfield. So if Arians isn't willing to budge, like everything is suggesting within what we're reading and hearing from him, and it's been a little bit limited, it's going to put Brady in a difficult situation at the age and his lack of mobility within the pocket. Now, again, there's some things that are coming out of just media clips here and there out of Brady, out of some of the guys on the team that lead to believe that there's some really good chemistry going on, at least initially. So coming around a little bit, but still, I think relative to what the market has posted right now, I'm going to be lower on Tampa Bay than a lot of other people are.
Should note that, of course, that is courtesy of Follow the Money here on VSiN, the Sports Betting Network, every morning, 7 a.m. Eastern time. Adam Chernoff with them discussing the Buccaneers' offseason and what it's going to look like there. And I would relatively agree, at least in terms of overvaluing Tampa Bay. And by the way, if they add Antonio Brown, which Arians had come out, I think, like a month ago and had really squashed it pretty hard on a CBS interview saying, like, it's not going to happen. He doesn't fit in our locker room. I wouldn't expect that. But where they stand right now, we talk about our market power ratings all the time, and Adam's right on in terms of, at least, and I would say, in terms of where the market rates this team. We're talking about the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, right, being a point behind the New Orleans Saints, being on line with the Dallas Cowboys, just 3 points behind a Kansas City Chiefs team. It's a Tampa Bay Buccaneers team we haven't seen this iteration of, and we haven't seen what Tom Brady looks like in this sort of system. Now, I'll say what I think is pretty interesting is you don't know really, and you can only take with what you hear. I would think that if you're Bruce Arians, because Adam, the numbers he's referring to, by the way, it's not even turnovers. You know, the quarterbacks that he mentioned, Carson Palmer, Ben Roethlisberger, Andrew Luck, Jameis Winston, all turnover-worthy plays. They committed 40 turnover-worthy plays, according to Pro Football Focus, all in their first years with Bruce Arians. All, of course, are all-time highs, so all tied for first with 40. So that's nuts in and of itself, and that's what Bruce Arians' system lends itself to. But as Adam pointed out, that's not who Tom Brady is. So I would think, right, that cooler heads would prevail, that this becomes a mesh of what Tom Brady did in New England and with what Bruce Arians wants to do with his system and how he's always done it. But at the same time, like in terms of value, I would say yes. Like if we're talking about a Tampa Bay team that is just coming together for the first time, we're talking about a Tampa Bay team who has had to deal with everything happening in terms of the pandemic and all of that and dealing with integrating a new team and new players in key spots. This is going to be interesting to see. And you see right now over at DraftKings, 9.5 the win total shaded at minus 125. You know, this is a team that I would kind of be along that same line. Not only just looking to maybe bet them like under a win total, things of that nature, but talking about point spreads on a week-to-week basis, at least until the market kind of settles down on them from that perspective, the first few weeks, maybe betting against them and taking them in some, or excuse me, taking their opponents in some big spots. But we are months away from the NFL season. Thanks to Follow Money for the clip. We'll be back. Major League Baseball, NL West on deck. Welcome back into The Edge here on VSiN, the Sports Betting Network. Oh, time flies so much. VSiN.com/subscribe. Make sure you check it out. VSiN Plus subs are free until a major sport returns. That means you get points for weekly out every single Wednesday, out right now. Make sure you check that out every single week, 10 a.m. Pacific time on Hump Day. And much more. Live shows, replays, afternoon emails. Sometimes Bill just sends like little emojis to you saying, what's up? How you doing? So check it out. VSiN.com/subscribe. And maybe, just maybe, Mitch Moss will email you personally and tell you how much he appreciates you. VSiN.com/subscribe. I made that up. All right, really quickly, because I am, you know, kind of into this and what's going on. The featured group, at least right now, in terms of the PGA Tour coverage, among them, Webb Simpson, who just missed. What do you guys think? Was that like a 9-foot putt for birdie that Webb Simpson just missed? You guys were just watching, I think, in that range. So he's sitting at 5-under, a little bit of a missed opportunity there for Webb Simpson. But again, your leader is still remaining the same. The quartet at 4-under, Seamus Power among them, as is Bryson DeChambeau, who had a fantastic day. So we'll see if any of this featured group can actually get it going and maybe start to push here for the top of the leaderboard. Nate Lashley, your defending champ, sitting at even, taking the tee right now over at 3. Let's see. Anything else to update on the tournament worth noting? It doesn't look like it, so let's get to Major League Baseball. All right, National League West is our division to preview today. Not surprising, the Los Angeles Dodgers at the top of this division in terms of the odds to win it, a 1-7 favorite to take the NL West in this shortened 60-game season. Two teams right behind them in terms of 10-1 odds, Arizona Diamondbacks, San Diego Padres, Colorado Rockies at 30-1 to take this bad boy, 200-1 for the San Francisco Giants to make a dent if possible. So, went into this thinking, because you have a minus 700 favorite to win this division, that obviously this is about, if there is any case, this is about making a case for anyone else to win the division other than Los Angeles. I don't need to spew all the wonderful and beautiful poetic things about the Los Angeles Dodgers, about their pitching staff with Walker Buehler near the top, which is absolutely loaded, and Clayton Kershaw, who, yes, is getting older and the velocity is going down, but is still extremely effective as a starting pitcher, to the depth in their bullpen, to the fact that their bench could probably trot out a starting nine, or excuse me, a line up of nine guys that would actually be really effective. The fact that the lineup is really balanced with left-handed power, we know what the Dodgers are. So let's take a look at the Arizona Diamondbacks, because I think this is interesting, the perception of the Arizona Diamondbacks versus the San Diego Padres. So now we noted that in that market, right, by the way, in terms of the odds to win the NL West, both teams sitting at 10-1, and yet to win the National League, Padres are at 15-1, Diamondbacks are at 25-1 to win the World Series, Padres are at 30-1, Diamondbacks are at 50-1. Market clearly has a little bit more respect for the San Diego Padres at this point right now than they do for the Arizona Diamondbacks. They're kind of the sexy young and up-and-coming team. I personally lean a little bit more towards the Arizona Diamondbacks. And by the way, their win totals, the Arizona Diamondbacks, despite the fact that the futures market is a little bit lighter on the Padres, again, 15-30-1 respectively for the pennant and the World Series, Arizona Diamondbacks win total, just one higher, 31.5 compared to 30.5 for the San Diego Padres. So, Arizona, first off, pitching staff, right? Is it going to be as good as we thought it was going to be? Remember, at the beginning of our, you know, stint here on the new revamped Edge for our buy low, sell high, Zach Gallen was the first pitcher that we talked about on our sell high list because the market may be overreacting, for lack of a better term, but maybe a little too high on a Zach Gallen, and some of the prices might be a little out of whack, right? We've talked about the issue that he's walking a lot of guys, hard contact rate's a little up, although he does strike out guys at a pretty high rate. So let's look at the rest of the staff, right? Madison Bumgarner, a fine addition to a pitching staff overall. There's some worrisome signs, in my opinion, though, about Madison Bumgarner as a starting pitcher, right? He is giving up more and more fly balls each and every year. In 2019, it was a career-low ground ball to fly ball ratio, 0.86. His ground ball rate, 35.8, was a career low, or a career high, excuse me, career low, sorry. His hard hit rate, a career high as well, 43.8. So these, to me, are worrisome signs for a guy like Madison Bumgarner, who's going to be near the top of your staff. Right, Robbie Ray, also part of the staff, one of my favorite pitchers to watch. The guy is a strikeout machine. It's nuts. Robbie Ray, though, essentially a fly ball pitcher, really dead even in terms of the ground ball to fly ball ratio. He's got a little bit of a home run problem. Home runs per nine last year was 1.5, so 1.5 homers every nine innings. The home run to fly ball ratio, not good at all, sitting at 20%. So Robbie Ray's got great strikeout numbers, but you worry about his command, and you worry about the fact that he gives up a lot of home runs, and that's not a recipe for success. If I give up free runners and I'm also having an issue keeping the ball in the park, it's not something that you want out of your starting pitching. Outside of Robbie Ray, Zach Gallen, Madison Bumgarner, I will say, like, Luke Weaver provides something really interesting. Like, this rotation's not terrible, right? I think I'm kind of going at the weaknesses a little strong, but the rotation, I think, overall for the Diamondbacks, it's really intriguing. I would give a little bit of an edge maybe in terms of the rotation to the San Diego Padres, because the Padres, in terms of their young staff, have a lot of good young talent that has really high upside. I think the question is, do they reach their upside right this season, or is it a few years to come? And again, over a 60-game sample size, you know, what's going to happen? Chris Paddock, a guy who, you know, a lot of people liked Chris Paddock last year, and there was a lot of signs to like about Paddock last year. Was he the one that showed up in the cowboy hat? Regardless, 142 thirds innings last year, 3.33 on the ERA. The xFIP was very respectable, 4.05. So there's a little bit of a difference there, but nothing worth worrying about or buying low or selling high on. Strikeout numbers are solid. The walk rate's good. The issue with Paddock was the home runs, kind of like Robbie Ray, 1.47 in terms of the home runs per nine. And the hard hit rate was over 40%. It was at 42.1. Somewhat worrisome and things that you want to look at with a pitcher, but overall the metrics are solid. Outside of that, Dinelson Lamet, coming off of a major injury but still very good, projects to have a fielding independent of about 497 or 397. So there's a lot to like about the staff. But I think the edge to me, when I'm looking at this overall, when you look at the futures market, when you're looking at the difference between the Padres and the Diamondbacks, if I'm making a case for one of these other teams to win this division, the edge to me goes with Arizona because of the lineup, because I think the lineup is actually, actually really interesting for the Arizona Diamondbacks, right? Sterling Marte projected to hit 289 in the leadoff spot. Kettle Marte behind him projected 296 with 9 homers and 30 RBI. They have a little bit of pop with Eduardo Escobar, who's projected to hit 10 and 34. Christian Walker is projected to hit about 10 home runs as well, but both are about 260 hitters. But what I like the most about the Diamondbacks lineup is there's balance, right? Projected over a 60-game season, right, they have three guys who get hit 280 to 300. Only one hitter is projected to hit double-digit home runs, but six of their projected lineup is in the range of 8 to 9 home runs. So there's a lot of balance with guys who are really effective in multiple parts of their game in terms of their swing. So that's what I find interesting about this Diamondbacks-Padres, I don't know if you want to call it, I guess you call it rivalry, whatever it is, with the market and the way these two teams view each other. You know, you look at the Padres lineup, and there's some intriguing pieces, but Tatis, Tommy Pham, projected to be 270 hitters, along with Manny Machado. That's near the top of your lineup, right? Your best hitter from an average perspective is going to be Machado at 273 or Pham at 276. But outside of that, you have a whole bunch of guys projected to hit about a 240, 250, 260 with some good pop, like Machado over 60-game season, probably 13 home runs. Tatis could hit 11. And defensively, the San Diego Padres have a lot to like. But if I'm taking this all as a whole, and if I'm making a case for one team outside of the Dodgers to win this, there's clearly a little bit more value with the Diamondbacks, and I think there's a little bit more to like if we're balancing it out with the Arizona Diamondbacks. And that's where I think if we're going to play this at all, you know, like 10-1 to win an NL West or anything like that, I'd rather have Arizona in my pocket than I would San Diego. And the odds are clearly diluted when you look at National League and World Series, considering that the public betting market really likes San Diego. So when we come back, NBA, nothing but analytics is a wrap of the edge and send you off into the weekend. Here on the edge as we get ready for the weekend. Happy 4th of July, by the way. Independence Day. God, what a great holiday. A couple of things really quick. One, projected cut looks like it's going to be 4 under, so keep an eye on that as these golfers are finishing up their second round of play. But the other that I wanted to point out, since we were talking about baseball in the last segment, is there's been, you know, and it's actually, if you go to ESPN.com, it's one of the top stories. There's been more and more rumblings about Mike Trout and whether or not he's going to be comfortable playing Major League Baseball. And you know, just a couple of days ago, we previewed the AL West. We talked about there being value with the Anaheim Angels, right, at 7-1 to win the AL West. But we've also brought up when it comes to any single future, whether it's Major League Baseball, whether it's NBA, whether it's hockey, you know, the danger of playing these futures this far out when you don't know how many of these guys are going to show up. And Mike Trout is being pretty vocal about whether or not he will show up and play, whether he's comfortable doing so. And there's also reports that a few guys for the Angels are already out with some unknown issue at this point. Whether or not it's a positive test, they don't know. So I would say keep an eye on the Angels situation. Again, I think if we can guarantee that they're getting their full roster and they're going to be there day one, 7-1 to win the AL West is very much worth the price. But with Mike Trout now, and I'd say over the last 24 hours, really showing some trepidation about returning to play, keep an eye on that situation before you go out and wager, and I would say any situation really, but keep an eye on that situation in Anaheim before you run out to bet the Anaheim Angels to win either division, World Series, whatever it is, because obviously without their best player, it's going to be a tough stretch with that pitching staff. Regardless, let's do it. God, just getting wrecked like that, it's so terrible. Yes, the Miami Heat, they are up. Cool, I got that right. I looked at the program feed. I wasn't sure if it was my right shoulder or left shoulder. It's my right. Miami Heat are our team of focus today on nothing but analytics. I wanted to start here. Before we get to the offensive and defensive weaknesses, as we usually do, you know, the Miami Heat fall in the same category as a Philadelphia 76ers, right? They are the top two teams when you look at how is the effect of the bubble going to play out for these teams, because they were so good at home and they were so bad on the road. So to refresh you about what went on with the Miami Heat, let's look at some of their numbers, right, and talk a little bit about what a neutral bubble would look like for them. So if you remember, home this season, the Miami Heat, 27-5 straight up, 19-12-1 against the spread. That's a 61.3 ATS rate, so covering 61.3% of the time. Very good, if you didn't know. With a 9.1 net rating, a positive 9.1 net rating, which was third best in the NBA. But then you hit their road numbers, and it's almost the opposite of what they had done. 14-19 straight up, 13-19-1 against the spread, a 40.6 clip ATS with a negative 2.8 net rating that was 17th best in the NBA. Their offense, as we kind of know, right, really falls off whenever they hit the road. The Miami Heat really, really interest me. Now, I should say, too, I have an 80-1 ticket on them to win the NBA Finals. They're sitting at 40-1 now. I'm not sure how far they're going to get in the postseason if they end up with the Philadelphia 76ers, which, by the way, Jacob, I don't know if you've seen this. So Zach Lowe, I'm a big fan of Zach Lowe, the work over at ESPN. They have his latest podcast. They preview the Heat, among other teams, and had talked about the Philadelphia 76ers as well, and that Philly actually, it would behoove them to move up and maybe take on a Miami as opposed to Boston. So who knows? Much smarter people than I say that I am wrong. Regardless, Miami Heat. So let's look at the offense. The offense, of course, a lot of strengths for the Miami Heat. One of the things that will stick out to you, other than the fact that they have the seventh best efficiency rating on offense, is the fact that the three-point shooting is nuts, right? Three-point shooting overall, 39.1%, first in the NBA. Non-corner three-point shooting, 39.2%. It is weird that they're the fourth best rim shooting team and get ranked 18th in corner three-point shooting. As we've talked about multiple times, right? Offensively, they kind of correlate. If you're good at the rim, you're good on the corners. Doesn't really work out with this Miami Heat team, but they're an effective three-point shooting team. It makes sense, right? They're loaded with long-range wings who can really shoot the ball. Even some of their bigs, like a Kelly Olynyk, can stretch the floor. Other things that they're fantastic. A half-court efficiency is solid at 99.1. Fast break efficiency, 126.5 points per 100 possessions in the fast break. That is the eighth best rate in the NBA. What I think is pretty intriguing about what goes on with the Miami Heat from an offensive standpoint is, and you see this with teams quite a bit, right, when it comes to their stars and their effect on the floor, and I'll pull up these numbers really quickly. When Jimmy Butler's off the floor, you see a pretty dramatic change with this team offensively, specifically, too, by the way, when it comes to the free throw rate. When Jimmy Butler's on the floor, that free throw rate spikes. It's one of the best free throw rates in the NBA. With him on the floor this season, their free throw rate climbs by 9.5 free throws made per 100 possessions. It's on the 100th percentile in the NBA with him on the floor. And with him off the floor, it obviously falls to a really low tier. So can they keep up in terms of getting to the free throw line with Jimmy Butler off the floor? He's become very good at drawing fouls from that perspective. But outside of that, the offense has a lot of balance. The bench has a lot of depth in terms of scoring and wings and shooting, right? We can talk about Goran Dragic coming off of the bench this year being a six-man candidate. We can talk about Tyler Hero and his shooting that he adds to the floor, a Myers Leonard type as well, which, by the way, the Myers Leonard numbers, I did not realize this with him on the floor. They're nuts. Like their net rating with Myers Leonard's on the floor is pushing 10 points, which is insane, considering that you would think Myers Leonard from a defensive standpoint is somewhat of a weak link, but he's really not, at least when it comes to defense and him being on the floor. So let's put this together with the defensive strengths, because this is where I think, to me, Miami's an interesting team. And to steal a stat that Zach Lowe had on his podcast, actually, I was listening to on the way in, how about this? So their three-point shooting defensively is a strength, clearly, right? Three-point shooting opponents, 34.7%, fourth in the NBA. Corner three-point shooting, 37.4% they give it to opponents, the eighth best rate in the NBA. Non-corner three-point shooting, 33.8%, fifth best in the NBA. This is why I wish I had access. All these NBA writers have these second spectrum stats, which are great. And according, apparently, to the second spectrum stats in ESPN, the Miami Heat rank first in terms of proximity of defenders to three-point shooters. So essentially meaning that they're fantastic on closing out on three-point shooters and getting there. Here's what I find interesting about Miami, though, because the perimeter defense, as you can clearly see, is absolutely fantastic. But what has, to me, come up as a common theme for really good teams, especially defensive teams and championship contender and caliber teams, is the fact that you cut off the rim, right? We've talked about this with the Milwaukee Bucks. We've talked about this with the Los Angeles Lakers. Like, teams that are very good defensively are usually very good within 4 feet. And we expanded even more, right, with Milwaukee, with Memphis. The fact that you give up three-point shots because it's more important to cut off the rim in the middle of the floor and then just let guys be inefficient from three-point range. And that's been a defensive scheme that Milwaukee's kind of ran with, and Memphis as well, with their former, of course, Milwaukee assistant leading the way. But that's a big weakness for the Miami Heat. They're giving up 65.7%, 25th in the NBA in terms of guarding around the hoop. And I don't know how much has to do with how they play, right, in terms of their big style, because Bam Adebayo will take some minutes at center, but for the most part, he plays a power forward that can take the ball up the floor. With Adebayo on the floor, the rim rate in terms of the shooting drops for opponents by 2.5%, so he's clearly a deterrent, but the shooting percentage around the rim is still in the mid-60s with Adebayo on the floor. So there's still nothing like they'll take fewer shots, but opponents are still just as effective. Is this a result of them, as we said, right? They have defenders that are always in the closest proximity to three-point shooters. Are they so set on actually guarding the perimeter that they leave lanes open to the rim? That's potential, right? But that's also somewhat worrisome. When you get into some matchups, like with Philadelphia, for example, right? Philadelphia, when they have Joel Embiid on the floor, one of the better teams at the rim. They're one of the better teams at drawing fouls as well. Does that work against you in matchups like that? Would they rather see a team like Indiana, who prefers to operate their offense in the mid-range, who, by the way, also, which would also help, right, might not have Victor Oladipo, and we talked about that, the big three a couple of days ago with Danny. But does a team that can really effectively, because I think the stats bear it out, can a team that effectively dominates you within 4 feet of the basket, can they take advantage of that and send Miami packing early on? And that's going to be interesting, too, is a matchup with Philadelphia, who they seem to have played well in the regular season. But does that work against them with this new lineup, with this floor spacing that Philadelphia now has? And does that really come up against them in a matchup with Indiana, who I think maybe Miami would prefer at this point? So you see their schedule, too, by the way. Nothing terrible. But again, like we talked about with Brian Windhorst earlier this week, strength of schedule I think is useless because you have no idea how some of these opponents are going to face these teams or handle these games. But Denver, Toronto, Boston, Milwaukee seems pretty tough at the top. And then you have Phoenix, Indiana, OKC, and Indiana again to round it out. And I think, to be honest with you too, right, let's talk about those two games on the 10th and the 14th against Indiana. Now, let's say by that time you've played five seeding games, you only have three left, and we get a good idea that they're going to play Indiana. How does Miami even handle those games? Do you just rest guys because you don't want to give away what you're going to be playing in a series against the Indiana Pacers? So that's going to be intriguing. So again, when you look at schedules like this, just make sure you don't take into account too much of what is going to happen for that perspective. But you can see too, by the way, over at DraftKings, championship odds at 30-1. There's no arguing that Miami is one of the more improved teams from where they were at the beginning of the year. What some of us, what I expected from them, I wasn't sure they were going to be this good. And clearly, right, sitting at 30-1 now when they were 300-1 and 100-1 in the offseason, 300 before the Jimmy Butler acquisition and 100 after, that they've improved quite a bit and the market now respects them. And they could be potentially, the fourth best team in the NBA in the Eastern Conference as it stands right now. But how this team is built and defensively how they can stand up really intrigues me because they're middle of the pack in overall efficiency. They give up a lot at the rim, and you can be great along the perimeter, but if you're constantly giving up runs at the basket, it's going to be something that is going to work against you. And by the way, too, middle of the pack in terms of fast break efficiency defensively and half court efficiency defensively. So nothing really crazy. And that's why you see, too, when we're looking at these stats, defensive strengths and weaknesses, it's obviously not every stat that we acquire. Some of these are middle of the pack and not worth noting, and some of the strengths and weaknesses. So there you go. The Miami Heat, nothing but analytics on them. Again, a team that offensively seems very skilled, but defensively does have some smaller issues when it comes to the NBA. By the way, we haven't gotten any update, too. I've been keeping an eye on this. I know we talked about this yesterday, and it kind of ties in to what we were talking about with Mike Trout. I am keeping an eye on what is happening with Washington because the more that we look at this and the way this bubble is shaking out, the more I'm really intrigued about what's going to happen with Bradley Beal. They also should also talk about this too, by the way. Two things. One, it looks like that the NBA is going to approve the eight teams that are outside of the bubble. It looks like they're going to approve some sort of fall league for them, some plays and everything like that. So we might have a different form of basketball coming in September. The other part too is Gordon Hayward. He is going to leave the bubble because, of course, he has a child on the way. It's going to be his fourth child. And so how that affects the Celtics in some of these seeding games, that's something to keep an eye on because obviously we don't know when exactly that is going to happen for Gordon Hayward. And on top of that, will he have to isolate for 14 days when he comes back to the bubble? So it's going to be fascinating, man. Keep an eye on these stories because they are very important for the handicapping. With that, we're all done here on The Edge. Missed out on any part of the show, remember vsin.com/podcast. Make sure you sign up for that email. You get it every single afternoon, loaded with lots of goodies and greetings and whatnot. Have a good weekend. Happy 4th of July. We will see you on Monday.